Good morning, everybody. Thanks for the meditations, fellas. Chad, you're going to fit in just fine here. Clarity, like your wife standing over you with a rolling pin. That's a line that I'm going to remember and use. But that was a great connection. I don't think I've ever heard a Lord's Supper meditation on that. And that was fantastic. That was really good. God puts a lot of these things in as illustrations. I mean, it is interesting how he uses the baker and the cupbearer, and then there's 3 days. And he says, remember me, and he doesn't. We don't want to be that cupbearer that gets restored to a position with the king, but then doesn't remember how we got there. You know, it's just fantastic. So I appreciate that. And Joel, that was a really great meditation too, you know, the encouragement not to be Nazis is always a good encouragement. The thing that I find really interesting about that is, you know, they used, you know, when they were on trial, they just said, I was just following orders. I was just doing what somebody in authority told me to do, and how we're not supposed to be like that. That's great encouragement. That applies, like you said, that applies to our jobs. That applies to, you know, politicians, whatever the case is. Guess who else applies to? That applies to your preacher. You don't do things just because your preacher tells you to do them. And I've always told you all that, and I will tell you that till I die. No one should ever do anything because somebody behind a pulpit says so. Jessica she's been in a choir, and she was in a concert last night at Grace Baptist Church in Richmond. Beautiful old church building right around all these really rich, richy areas. And you could fit several hundred people in there. And it's just a beautiful, you know, kind of old building. And so I got on their website and looked, and you think Baptists, okay, well, they're conservative, right? No, they're one of the liberal Baptists. You know, they're rainbow flag, you know, they have two preacherettes that run it down there, pastorettes, whatever you want to call them. Pastor Courtney, Reverend Dr. Pastor Courtney, I think is her full title. And I was sitting next to Jaden, and I said, I wonder how many people are going to be here tomorrow hearing a bunch of lies being told. And they're going to do it because someone with a robe and a frock tells them to do it. Because they're the authority figure. Nah, folks, we don't roll like that. Romans 13. Romans 13. We're going to finish up with the message that we started a couple weeks ago. And it's one verse, Romans 13:8. Owe nothing to anyone except to love one another, for he who loves his neighbor has fulfilled the law. And we started talking last week, or 2 weeks ago, we didn't get very far, about the concept in the Old Testament about how God removed debts every 7 years and restored slaves, freed slaves as well. And then in the year of Jubilee, that slavery was reversed. And then all land reverted back to the original owners. Because the one thing that God hated was perpetual debt. So when God created a government, he created a way that debts could be wiped out every 7 years so nobody would become enslaved to debt. And so we started talking about this a little bit, about how this all works out of Deuteronomy 15. And today we're going to be getting more into our society. So, you know, my background is finance. I was involved in that from 2000 to 2022. So I'm familiar with this world. And I'll tell you this, debt is a huge issue. And I'm going to explain to you how it works in our society and in our economy. So we're going to be talking about high finance today. And some people think, well, that's not biblical. God tells us all about economy economics in the Old Testament. And he lays out very specific principles that a nation, if they ever want to last, is to implement if they want to stay free. And one of the key aspects in Deuteronomy 15 that God stated was that nations should never borrow from other nations. Never. It's one of the key aspects. So let's take a look at some of the other things that they mentioned. Let's go to, we're going to be flying around here a little bit. Let's go to Ezekiel chapter 18. So Ezekiel 18, we're going to get into this section in a couple weeks in Isaiah when we talk about the watchman. The book of Ezekiel, just to have a little bit of reference, Ezekiel was one of the 10,000 people carried captive from Jerusalem over to Babylon when Nebuchadnezzar came the second time and came after the city. And so Ezekiel's job was to prophesy to those 10,000 captives in what's called the diaspora, in the remnant that was left, about what these people needed to do. And his job was to tell them, Jerusalem's going to be destroyed and you guys need to repent. So he mentions, if you look at verse 17, he lists all of the sins. And I'm not going to get into the context of this. All right. So let's go back to verse 15, actually. Let's stay in verse 17. I don't have time to keep going over this. So he's talking about what repentance looks like. He says, he keeps his hand from the poor, does not take interest or increase, but executes my ordinances and walks in my statutes. He will not die for his father's iniquity. He will surely live. The whole concept here is, sons don't die for their father's sins. Fathers don't die for their son's sins. Everyone's got enough sin of their own. If they continue in it, they die. If they repent, they live. That's the bottom line. It's also a really powerful argument against original sin, but we're not going to go there. The concept is this. In the law, God said, you are not to charge interest to your brothers and sisters, to your fellow Israelites. And one of the reasons the nation was destroyed, outside the murder, outside the idolatry, outside of all the sin that they did, he lists very clearly here, lending your money to a brother with interest. They were not allowed to do that. So I got on the website and I went to modern day Israeli banking. If you're a Jew and you go to an Israeli bank to borrow money, guess what they do? They charge you interest. If they were actually following the law, they wouldn't charge interest to fellow Israelis. But they do. God destroyed them for that. Things don't change. So when it comes to Christians, if we ever have a chance to do business with each other, that's one of the things that we should never do. Charge each other interest. But funny thing is, I hear about Christians charging other Christians interest. It's like, well, no. The New Testament doesn't expressly forbid it. It's an Old Testament concept. But is there anything in the New Testament that would make it sound like it's okay to do that? Not at all. Not at all. So just a little side note there for us. I want to talk about the history of debt in America. Because the way debt used to run back in the founding of the country is not how debt runs today. Debt today is very, very different than it used to be. So let's talk about this. Mortgages in America. There were no mortgages in America, hardly any, before 1860. No mortgages. After 1860 and the National Banks Act, mortgages increased. The early 1900s is when mortgages became a thing. And here's how they ran back then. A typical mortgage was 50% down. 50% cash down. Interest only with a 5-year balloon. So here's what that means. You put 50% down. Your payment was interest only. And in 5 years, you owed the entire rest of the amount. Now, let me ask you a question. What do you think that would have done for home prices? If people wanted, that's exactly right, Josh. If people wanted to sell their house, they would have had to have priced it so that people could afford it. And if you had to come up with 50% down and you had to pay the balance off in 5 years, the home prices would be dramatically lower. By the way, at that particular time, there was also early 1900s, but this is before 1912, 13, 14, when the state or federal income tax was created. There was no federal income tax, and we were still on a gold standard with no fiat currency. So you could save money a lot easier, You kept the money that you earned, and it wasn't flying out at 50% to the federal, states, and local governments. Okay. So people did renegotiate these loans very often and kind of kick the can down the road, but it would keep the price of real estate much more reasonable. Now, after World War II, the GI Bill was introduced, and prices skyrocketed because the federal government got involved with subsidizing mortgages. Now, I'm really thankful for the service that our vets put forth, and I think y'all deserve all the benefits that you can get. 100%. My problem is this. Anytime subsidies, and if you look at this, anytime subsidies come into the picture. Now, what do we mean by subsidies? Subsidies are the federal government propping up and giving money to independent business to prop it up, to make it work. Anytime subsidies come into the picture, prices automatically increase. Let's think about health insurance for a second. What do you think the cost for healthcare procedures would be if health insurance providers did not exist and people had to pay for those things out of their own pocket? If hospitals wanted to make money, if doctors wanted to get any money at all, and they were dependent completely upon the people that they were serving to get them, their prices would be much lower and much more reasonable. It wouldn't cost you $37,000 for a 24-hour emergency room visit in any way, shape, or form. When we had our kids, I think the price, wasn't it like $6,000 or $7,000 to have our kids? Some of y'all just had kids. What's the cost today? 30, 40 grand to have a kid. You know, Jaden's only 22, so that was 22 years ago. Look at how much prices have increased. Why is that? Because the federal government's involved in subsidizing health care, and health insurance is involved too. Causes these things to dramatically increase. Now, the prices for real estate is skyrocketed again in the 2000s due to relaxed requirements for loans and the packaging of loans for securitization. We're going to talk about that here in a second. Car loans. Anybody know when the first car loan was made? That's an interesting little trivia. It's way earlier than I thought. 1919. That's when GMAC started, General Motors Acceptance Corp. That's when they first started and started giving loans for cars. I did not know that. But even though they started giving loans, most people paid cash for cars. Car prices increased when auto loan terms started to increase. Anybody know what the longest term that you have now to buy a car? 10 years. They range from 36 to 120 months. Is there any doubt why, like, a new F-250 costs $95,000? My first house cost $72,500. I mean, if I wanted to go and buy a new Camry, like I have a Camry out there, it's 11 years old, but I bought it new. It was a little bit over $20,000 when I bought it. To buy the same car now, I'd have to spend about $35,000. But I could finance it for 8 years. Now, I know it's a Toyota, but still. Credit cards. Anybody know the first revolving credit card? Kind of credit cards we see today. Anybody know the first company to put it out? Not American Express. Close. Diners Club. Victoria, you remember Diners Club? I remember Diners Club. I remember Diners Club. The first bank credit card. And by the way, Diners Club, 1946. First bank credit card was Bank of America in 1958, which became Visa. My point is this. When government gets involved, it's not good. Sorry, let me rephrase that. When governments and banks get involved, it's not good. Banking is not like it used to be. Ever since the central bank was created and then we moved over to a fiat currency, what I mean by fiat currency is a currency that's not tied to gold or any kind of a concrete value. Everything has changed. In fact, there's a quote that I want to read you. So there's a guy named Murray Rothbard. He's a von Mises Institute guy, anarcho-capitalist. So I don't agree with a lot of some of the stuff that he says, because he believes in stateless societies, and I'm not an anarchist, so I don't believe in stateless societies, because as we talked about, God created government. I think the one of the concepts behind anarchy is that people are inherently good. Do you believe that? No, me either. That makes me laugh. He's talking about free markets in the banking system. And here's his quote. Many free market advocates wonder, why is it that I am a champion of free markets, privatization, and deregulation everywhere else, but not the banking system? The answer should now be clear. Banking is not a legitimate industry providing legitimate service. So long as it continues to be a system of fractional reserve banking, that is the fraudulent making of contract that is impossible to honor. Let me explain fractional reserve banking to you. I'll try to use an illustration that I can adequately tell. You'll be able to understand it, but hopefully I can adequately tell it. So let's say you deposit $100 into a bank. A bank at that particular point, I think the conversion is 7-to-1. Let's just use 7-to-1. The bank is then able to loan out $700 because it took in $100 of hard assets. So let's say the bank goes ahead and loans out $700 from your $100. Is that real money? It was created out of thin air. It doesn't exist. That's fractional reserve banking. It creates money out of thin air that doesn't exist. You can't do that when you have a currency that's tied to gold. Because if somebody deposits $100 of gold, that's $100. It's not $700. And if you need to loan out $700 of gold, what do you need in your reserves in order to be able to do that? You need to have the $700 worth of gold. But because we're not tied to gold, because we have a fiat currency, which is presto, wavo, your hando, and you create it. You take in 100, and you can now loan out 700. And even I don't even think that necessarily is how it's supposed to work, as you're going to see here in a second. So anybody know what the national debt is right now? $34 trillion. And I was looking at it this morning, and I watched it for 15 seconds, a real live calculator, and it went up $1 million in those 15 seconds. Because that's how much debt we are creating. Anybody want to guess as to how much debt total, personal, corporate, and government debt there is in the United States? Because you think $34 trillion is a big number. Anybody want to guess how much total debt is in the country right now? Very close. $78 trillion. Chad says $80 trillion. You hear the word GDP thrown out a lot, right? Gross domestic product. There's two numbers. There's gross domestic product. There's gross national product. Gross domestic product is the entire amount of economic production in the country, but it doesn't matter if it's done by United States citizens or foreign companies working in the United States. Okay, it's just the total amount of production that is created inside of the United States. Gross national product is the gross amount of production that's created by Americans no matter where they live. Okay, two different numbers. The gross domestic product, the amount of production, economic production in the United States, is $21 trillion. So our country is leveraged about four times what it produces on an annual basis.
By the way, I found this out too. This is really fascinating statistic. You know, the big thing is TikTok, because TikTok is owned by the Chinese, and they're like, oh, we need to ban TikTok.
How many Chinese companies do you think operate, wholly owned Chinese companies operate in the United States of America? 5,000. 5,000. But yet they're picking on one. Smithfield, that's a big Virginia name, right? Smithfield Ham. That's owned by the Chinese. They own a ton of our food. Bill Gates is buying up the rest of it. So I had a question. My question was, how much money can be made off of debt? We have $80 trillion worth of debt. How much money can be made off of debt? Most of the time you think just the interest, right? I mean, if you have a $100,000 loan and it's at 5%, the person, you know, there's $5,000 a year being generated off that, right? And so you just take that $80 trillion, figure out what the interest rate is, and that's how much money is being made off of it, right? No. First off, there's something called securitization. So one of the things that they do is they take these loans and they package them up. They're called derivatives. And they take these loans, they all these different types of debts, they package them up, and then they sell them. So what they can do is they'll take, let's take one that probably a lot of people are familiar with, something called mortgage-backed securities. They're collateralized mortgage obligations, CMOs. What they do is they take all these mortgages, they package them up, and they don't take all of the mortgages and package them up, but they take mortgages and they package them up in different products. How many of you have had a mortgage and it was sold? A lot of you, right? Okay. So I remember when we bought our first house down in Florida, I went through my bank, Huntington, to get the loan, and then they promptly sold it. And they sold it to somebody else, but Huntington still serviced it. So my checks still went to Huntington, but they had sold the bank or sold the mortgage. What they did is they took my loan, they packaged it with other mortgages of varying qualities, high quality, medium quality, and low quality that we might know as subprime. They take them and then they package them up and then they sell them. Then what the people, then what, so you think, okay, great, they sell them, they make money off of it, and there's stuff that's being, revenue being generated. But they don't really own the underlying asset. The underlying asset is still at the bank. But they've taken that and they've packaged it and they've sold it to investors. Then what they do is they'll take those that they've sold to investors, they'll package those and sell them to new investors. They'll take some of those and they'll package them up and sell them to new investors. Then they'll take those and package them up into $80 trillion of debt. Guess how much the derivatives market is worth right now? Okay, so we have $21 trillion gross domestic product, right? The derivatives market is worth $600 trillion. Because they've taken the same asset and repackaged it over and over and over and over again and resold it. And I happen to know a derivatives attorney who draws up these contracts. And so I asked her one time, what would happen if the underlying mortgages failed? They said it would cause a cascading effect throughout the economy and collapse these derivatives. That's what happened in 2008. That's what caused the crash in 2008, the subprime mortgage fiasco, where a lot of these mortgages started to fail and the derivative instruments that were used to repackage them and sell them started to fail as well. That's why the federal government injected $1 trillion into the economy to try to get these things to stop. The first derivative was created, this should not shock anybody, by J.P. Morgan. In 1993. Now, I'm going to read something else to you here. You're going to see why I'm doing all this here in a second. This all has a point.
last year there was a hearing in Congress where the derivative exposure of agriculture, of farmers, was put on display and saying these derivatives that are on the agricultural industry pose a systemic existential risk to the American economy. That amount of exposure is $2 trillion. There's $2 trillion of derivative risk inside of the agricultural industry. And all of these bankers came and economists came and said, this is an existential risk. If anything starts to happen to our food sources, to our crops, and these things start to unwind, it'll collapse our economy. $2 trillion. There are three banks in the United States, J.P. Morgan, Citibank, and Goldman Sachs, that combined, just those three banks, own $126 trillion of derivatives. Remember Too Big to Fail? From 2008, we can't let these banks get too big to fail. How in the world are you going to bail out a bank or three banks that own $126 trillion of derivatives? In 1996, derivatives at U.S. Bank represented just 63% of the world GDP. Today, it's almost 200% of world GDP. In other words, my point is this. Debt, God knew what he was talking about. If all debt was erased every 7 years, these derivatives would not exist, because the debt that they're based on would not exist. Now we're at a point, because there's no such thing as real money, that the entire economy is hanging on a knife's edge because of fake assets, imaginary assets that have been created by banks, specifically the three biggest banks. And they're not even really the biggest. Goldman Sachs is technically considered a bank. You know, you think banks are supposed to have reserves, right? Assets in reserve. So in other words, you go to a bank and you put your money in there. That's called a demand deposit. So you go to a bank, you open up a checking account or a savings account, you put $1,000 in. That's called a demand deposit, which means you can go at any time and demand that money out and they owe it to you. That's the way it's supposed to work. Now, take Goldman Sachs, for example. Goldman Sachs owns $52 trillion in derivatives. Guess what the dollar amount of assets they have backing up $52 trillion of derivatives? Only $538 billion. Do you see why Ron Paul says that we're broke? If you know who Ron Paul is, he always used to say that America's broke. Our banking system is a joke. My point is, with all of this, do not put your trust in our financial system. Be rich toward God. This is just one aspect, derivatives. There's also securitized debt called bonds. Corporate bonds, municipal bonds, people buy them. They've been buying and selling them for years. The bond trading market is $800 billion a day, $201 trillion a year, buying and selling this debt back and forth. And the way that they work is banks make money on the spread. So for each one of those $201 trillion, they're making $1, $2, $5, $10 on all of that. So there's trillions of dollars being made, billions of dollars probably being made from banks selling, or in brokerages selling this. So my question about this convoluted system is this: who's actually slave to whom? You think you go to the bank and they own all these assets and they're doing you a favor by loaning you money? They create the money out of thin air. There's no risk for them at all. It's a completely fake industry. all because we have fiat currency, not backed by gold, and these securitizations have increased so much. This is why housing is the way it is. You know, we have all these private equity companies, right, that are buying up all the real estate, which is why you can't buy houses today, right? Some of you are trying to buy a house. We have given up on trying to buy a house. You try to buy a house in a Richmond area, and a lot of times, I mean, the Wheelers can tell you, they wanted to go look at three houses yesterday. All three were under contract before they could even look at them. Houses are going under contract 1, 2, 3 days max. And a lot of times what ends up happening is you have these private equity companies, people like BlackRock, coming in, paying over asking price with no housing inspection, and people are selling to them left and right. Do you know what BlackRock does with these assets once they have them? They borrow against them. They leverage them to the hilt. Then they take that money and they invest it. They're making money hand over fist because of debt. And they're pricing everybody out of the market. You have all of these people that are going and getting, you know, they're buying all these homes and everything, and they're leveraging them out. And they're going and buying more homes. Meanwhile, the common individual, common people like us, you have to do one of two things. We either have to overextend ourselves tremendously, or we have to just not do it. You got to have a house. It's not necessarily the best move to rent forever. It's not necessarily the best stewardship. Now, hopefully the economy will change, and you know, interest rates might come down, and whatever the case is. I mean, these things are cyclical. I get that. They are cyclical. But we're seeing things a little bit different now. And a lot of this stuff is brought about because the banking system and the investment houses have figured out that they can package and repackage and repackage the same loans 1,000 times. You and I both know you cannot thumb your nose at the economic laws that God created forever. It can't be done. Proverbs chapter 22. Proverbs chapter 22. Well, this is gloom and doom, isn't it? Let's talk about the positive stuff. Because I tell you what, we're not victims. Don't ever think of yourself as a victim. Proverbs 22, starting at verse 7, it says, "The rich rules over the poor, and the borrower becomes the lender's slave." And then verse 9, "He who is generous will be blessed, for he gives some of his food to the poor." See, the concept is this. When we recognize that when you get into unhealthy debt, you become a slave, right? We're to owe nothing to anyone except love. Now, let's go back to Romans 13 for a second. Let's talk about some positive things here to end this, because I don't think we're victims at all. I think this gives us an opportunity to really utilize the situation we find ourselves in to glorify God. Back there in Romans 13:8, where he says, "Owe nothing to anyone except to love one another. He who loves his neighbor has fulfilled the law." That word for owe means ought or obligated. It means something that you're obligated to do. So many times in the scripture, this word is translated ought, that we ought to do something. In other words, there's an ethical and moral responsibility to stay out of debt that enslaves. Now, I understand economy runs on debt. You can't get away from it, right? What I'm trying to say is this. Number one, be careful for what you go into debt for. I firmly believe that most people have no business having a credit card. And that's coming from somebody who had a lot of credit card debt at one time. If you have a credit card that has, I think it's like about an 18, 19% interest rate, and you pay the minimum payment, it's going to take you 30 years to pay that credit card off. And you will pay off over double the amount that you charged on the card. If you're going to use credit cards, use them responsibly. I use a credit card for everything. Almost all of my bills go on a credit card. I pay off the statement balance every single month so that there is zero. We've had this credit card for years. We've never been charged 1 cent in interest. But the reason I use it is because I get miles. I'm flying to Montana or North Dakota on Wednesday. I didn't pay one red cent for that ticket. Well, I think I paid like $15 for a processing fee because of the miles. Right? So use them for those purposes. You know, sometimes I understand you might be short on money and you need to charge some stuff on there for a little bit, but make sure that you're paying that off as fast as you can. Credit card debt's one of the worst things you can get involved in. That one of the other things, please make sure that when you're using debt for, say you have to purchase a car. Car's one of the worst assets you can buy. It depreciates immediately as soon as you get it. Don't buy more of a vehicle than what you need. A lot of these flashy things that are out there, they're just another thing to go wrong with the car, right? All the electronics and everything like that. Don't get into so much debt that you're struggling to breathe. One of the things that defines a Christian is contentment. Slip over to 1 Timothy chapter 6, and we're going to wrap up here. 1 Timothy chapter 6. Verse 6, 1 Timothy 6, 6. But godliness actually is a means of great gain when accompanied with contentment. For we have brought nothing into the world, so we cannot take anything out of it either. If we have food and covering, with these we shall be content. We need to learn how to be content people. Thankful for what we have. Having that desire to have something else just gnaw away at you can help us make really bad financial decisions. So let's make sure we're content. God talks about Babylon in Revelation 18. And Babylon is the financial system that overrides the world, that's over the kings of the earth, that people use to spend on their pleasures. Now, according to the book of Revelation, what happens to Babylon? She's thrown down and destroyed. And what is God's deep exhortation to his people in regard to Babylon? Come out from her. We can't let the materialism and pleasure seeking cause us to get involved in a system that is absolutely ungodly and is designed to put us into slavery. We need to use these things properly, utilizing contentment as a way of being proper stewards of our money. And next week or the week after, we'll get into this. The only thing we have a debt to is love. That's what we owe. Because we've been loved more than we can ever return. And God says, because I've loved you this much, this is what you're indebted to with each other. Isn't it interesting? And I'm going to end on this concept. I think you can learn a lot from the Amish. A lot of the Amish and the Mennonites are exceedingly wealthy. You know why? Because they've never gotten into debt. You know what else they do? They help each other. Someone builds a house, the whole community comes together and builds it. Someone has a medical bill, the whole community comes in and gives towards it, so they have no insurance. They're on zero government welfare, no Social Security, none of it. I think we can learn a lot from that. Maybe it's time for Christians around the country to come together and maybe be a little bit more interdependent, like the first century church was. I don't know how. I don't know the answers. I don't know the procedure. I'm just saying that the way it works now typically doesn't work. And the way the economy is now probably isn't going to work going forward. But the one thing I'm really excited about is that God has set us free from all debt. So let's not become slaves of others.